Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Over the past 20 years, most large American cities have seen an astonishing drop in violent crime. In some cases, a drop of more than 75%. Now, there are lots of theories about why: policing, incarceration, the economy as a whole. But Patrick Sharkey says that one factor doesn't get the attention it deserves: the on-the-ground effectiveness of community nonprofit organizations. Sharkey says, through numerous studies, he's found that each additional nonprofit dedicated to confronting violence leads to a measurable 1% drop in a city's murder rate. So Sharkey's calling for a new wave of investment into these nonprofits. He's the chair of the sociology department at New York University and author of the new book, Uneasy Peace: The Great Crime Decline, The Renewal of City Life, and The Next War on Violence. Patrick Sharkey joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So there have been many theories over the past several years about why we've seen this dramatic decrease in crime. What do you conclude is the most likely reason for
the decline? Well, there are a lot of exotic theories, and I don't dismiss any of them, but I think what actually happened is more straightforward. In the early 1990s, police forces were bolstered. They became more aggressive. They started to shut down open-air drug markets. That reduced violence. They cracked down on gang activity. The incarceration rate continued to increase at the same time. But then there were other set of changes as well. Private security guards proliferated across the country. Cities started implementing closed-circuit recording systems for entire sections of neighborhoods. And then one last piece, which is often ignored in these discussions, is that the communities hit hardest started to mobilize against violence. And so what I show in the book is that the number of nonprofits specifically formed to build stronger neighborhoods and to confront violent crime exploded in the 1990s. And the evidence that I generate and describe in the book shows that that played a very big role in changing the face of city neighborhoods and reducing violence.
So I definitely want to talk about that last part in detail in a moment. But can we go back to the first part of what you said about law enforcement and laws changing and mass incarceration? Because now, through the lens of 2017, 2018, for the past several years, there's been a renewed discussion about the overreach of those laws and how mass incarceration led to the imprisonment of largely African American and Latino young men who were nonviolent, and that caused its own entire set of problems.
Yeah, so I think we have to have an honest conversation about the data here. And more police on the street reduces crime. We know that with pretty good confidence. The evidence is really strong. Incarceration is much less clear. The excessive incarceration that happened, particularly post-1990, where nonviolent offenders were being put away for a very long time, I think there's a pretty close to a consensus that that was not effective in further reducing violence.
And in fact, damaged the very communities that these people came
from. Absolutely. There have been great costs that have come from this approach, the punishment model, and have led to a situation, where now there are almost 7 million Americans who are under the surveillance of the criminal justice system, whether they're in jails, prisons, on parole, or probation. And I think everyone is in agreement at this point, politicians across the political spectrum, with some notable exceptions, but most politicians on the left and right agree that this is targeted toward the most disadvantaged segments of society and really has to change.
Now, in your book, you talk about how the great crime decline, as you put it, has also created in its wake a new American city. This is absolutely true in aggregate, right? But I'm thinking, and again, specifically here with the example of Boston, that absolutely the crime rate has gone down. But nevertheless, what we've also seen is a continued concentration of high crime areas down to the area of, a couple of blocks in particular neighborhoods. That's the thing. We can look at things sort of at the high level and the averages look good. But if you're living in one of those neighborhoods where not much has changed, it doesn't feel so great.
Absolutely. It's a great point. And it's a reason why there's still urgency. So a huge amount of violence is concentrated in a very small number of street segments within neighborhoods and is concentrated among a very tiny fraction of the population within those neighborhoods. That also makes it a problem that is more manageable to deal with, meaning instead of saturating entire communities, with, you know, aggressive police, and we can focus on those specific hotspots where violence is still around.
So let's go back to the third part of this complex mix that you were talking about, and that is communities and cities themselves being very proactive about the violence and the crime in their neighborhoods. Can you give us a couple specific examples?
Sure. I mean, there are plenty of examples. Here in Boston, the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative, which was a well-known organization that formed a while back, and the goal was not specifically or exclusively to confront violence. The goal was to build a stronger community. You know, that Boston 10-Point Coalition is another great example. These types of organizations, they're not isolated examples. So something happened at that point in time in the late 80s, early 90s in particular. Residents working with community leaders developed these organizations to fight back, to take back their neighborhoods, to confront violence. So that story of mobilization at the very local level is left out of discussions about why crime fell.
Well, here in Boston, we also had, in that same time period you're talking about, with the local mobilization, we had these very important community groups who were working with law enforcement, right? I mean, the Boston Miracle, as it's called. So it was local mobilization plus cooperation with law enforcement and law enforcement's cooperation with them, which I think it was the two in concert that produced such dramatic changes here in Boston.
Yeah, it's a great point. When you look at cities and try to figure out why, you know, why the initiatives within a city are working or are not working, the biggest signal is whether the local community organizations are working effectively with law enforcement as well as city government. And if those three groups are working together, then that's a great signal that violence is not going to explode in that city. And I actually think if you look in the past few years, we've seen a rise in violence, a spike that's been limited to specific cities. And, you know, it's impossible to say exactly what has gone on in each city, but I do think the cities where crime hasn't fallen as much, the cities where we've seen recent spikes, are places where those three groups, community organizations, law enforcement, and city government, are either dysfunctional, in some cases corrupt, or just are not working well together. And that's a signal that crime might be about to rise.
So back to the title of the book, An Uneasy Peace. Are you indicating there that this peace that we have now, put that in quotes, is not sustainable?
Well, the way we got here is no longer seen as tolerable, is not sustainable. So there's been more and more attention to police violence. There's been more attention to mass incarceration, and for good reason. So what's the next model?
Yeah. That's the question,
right? That I kind of grapple with the book. And what I argue is that we have to shift from a model that focuses on punishment toward a model that focuses on investment. When I talk investment, I mean we have to think about violence as something that we can deal with by investing in community organizations, residents, and law enforcement to give them the resources they need to work together at a very local level to control violence. That seems like a very academic, pie-in-the-sky thing to say, but we have very good evidence that local organizations, when they have the resources to be sustainable, are extremely effective in controlling violence.
Well, and target those resources, right?
Exactly.
Because, I mean,
exactly.
Again, I'm thinking about Boston, and we have some numbers from the Boston Police Department that say the majority of violent crime in Boston is located in just three neighborhoods, Dorchester, Mattapan, and Roxbury. In fact, in Roxbury, a third of all homicides happen in just that one part of the city. So I guess what I'm hearing you call for is a major increase in investments in those particular places that are most vulnerable to crime right now.
That's right. So I think the biggest challenge is to develop plans for those specific hotspots. But it's also an argument for developing institutions that can stabilize those neighborhoods. So it's not just targeting the specific spots and people who are most likely to be engaged in violence. It's targeting institutions and supporting institutions.
What kind of institutions?
I'm talking about, you know, nonprofit organizations, the organizations that are central to every neighborhood across the country. But if you walk down the streets of Dorchester, then you notice that there are certain blocks that don't have it, that don't have that core, what I call it, as a community quarterback. And I got that from an organization called Purpose Built Communities. And their idea is to build organizations who have the explicit responsibility to look out over the community, you know, that kids can get to community centers unharmed, feeling safe. And this kind of organization, whether it's a religious organization, whether it's a social service provider, whether it's a Boys and Girls Club, these kinds of organizations, when they're in place, then a neighborhood is much less likely to go downhill.
You know, all due respect to your scholarship, but it sounds like you are bringing deep analysis and data to something that folks in those neighborhoods have been saying for a long time, right? That, like, we need jobs, we need economic development, we need civic support.
So what I'm arguing is now we have an evidence base to really make large-scale investments in these organizations. We have very rigorous experimental studies of the effectiveness of, you know, specific programs like summer jobs programs. In Chicago, there's a very well-known program called Becoming a Man that combines after-school sports programs with cognitive behavioral therapy. And this reduced violence by half, okay? Hmm. So what I'm arguing is community activists have been saying this for a long time, and they will tell me to my face, we don't need your study to confirm what we've known. But the truth is now we have really strong evidence suggesting not that every organization is going to be effective, but that a community is much less likely to go downhill if it has strong institutions that is built upon.
So last question for you, because I feel like every important conversation I've had over the past couple of years about, you know, how do we continue to support and build up our cities and neighborhoods, a lot of it ultimately comes down to how do we mitigate the effects of inequality? I mean, do you see, you know, ever-expanding rates of income inequality as being part of this picture?
I think if inequality leads to disinvestment in communities, in other words, as neighborhoods become more unequal, if that leads to political disinvestment in low-income communities, which happened in the 1970s, which happened in the 1980s, back then, that's why violence started to rise. It was not just poverty, it was disinvestment. If that happens again, and I think there is a valid concern that it is happening or it will happen, then I think we are at risk of communities falling apart. So there has to be that sustained investment in urban communities. And it's the same investment that's taken for granted all over the country, but it has not always been present in low-income communities of color.
Hmm. Well, Patrick Sharkey is the chair of New York University's Sociology Department. He's also scientific director of Crime Lab New York and author of the book Uneasy Peace, The Great Crime Decline, The Renewal of City Life, and The Next War on Violence. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.